the Obbligato Recitative, number 5 of Schoenberg's 5 pieces for orchestra, performed by the St. Louis Symphony, conducted by David Robertson. And that was the original orchestration, which Schoenberg wrote in 1908 for a large orchestra. He subsequently did rewrite it for a much smaller ensemble, but the version we heard tonight, with the mighty forces of the St. Louis Symphony, was as he had first intended it. David Robertson shaking the hand of David Halen before leaving the stage, returning in just a few moments to perform some Gershwin. He mentioned, didn't he, in that interview earlier, that Schoenberg was a great friend of the multi-talented, multifaceted, commercially successful, always popular George Gershwin. They were friends and neighbours in L.A. They were tennis partners, they were chess buddies, and the very wealthy Gershwin sponsored some of Schoenberg's work. I found a marvellous film on YouTube of Schoenberg and various pals, which was shot by Gershwin himself, and you can see the tennis court in the background. It's really atmospheric, great fun to watch. Now, when it came to music, the two of them were, perhaps quite surprisingly, huge admirers of one another. Schoenberg wrote later about Gershwin, "I know he is an artist and a composer. He expressed musical ideas, and they were new, as is the way in which he expressed them." When you listen to the next piece, which is Gershwin's popular American in Paris, written in Europe and meant, as the title suggests, to tell the tale of a tourist in Montparnasse, just think of how much the two composers must have listened to each other's work and influenced each other's orchestration. Well, on the surface, an American in Paris is a really light piece. It's rather a fun piece for an American orchestra's debut performance here at the Proms, too. At its premiere, opinion was, well, it was mixed. Most people loved it, after all. It was Gershwin, they loved all his music. But some critics liked it, they called it happy and full of life. Others, though, hated it, calling it silly and long-winded. But let's be honest, it's nearly 90 years on, and it's still being played and enjoyed in concert halls around the world. I think Gershwin might be having the last laugh. He wrote the piece in the spring of 1928. He was travelling in Paris, meeting some of his heroes like Prokofiev and Ravel, Milo and Poulenc. The story goes that he asked Ravel for lessons in orchestration, and the older man refused, saying there was nothing that he could teach Gershwin that he hadn't already mastered. In his words, Gershwin wanted this orchestral work to portray the impressions of an American visitor in Paris as he strolls about the city and listens to the various street noises and absorbs the French atmosphere. There is a section as well, though, when clearly that American visitor gets rather homesick, and you can hear the American blues influence then to reflect that. But let us hear it now. Gershwin's American in Paris, David Robertson returning to the stage to hear, to conduct these Americans in London, the St. Louis Symphony. Thank you. Gershwin's An American in Paris, performed by the St. Louis Symphony under David Robertson at this, their debut prom. Their musical director, David Robertson, coming back to the stage now, climbing up the stairs to bring the percussion section to their feet. And indeed, they're getting a standing ovation from some people very near me. And then the extensive brass section. With special mention possibly going to the saxophonists, Nathan Nabb, J. Michael Holmes, and Adrienne Honnold. Leader, concertmaster David Halen taking a bow. And a minor change of personnel taking place now on the stage, with David Robertson bringing everybody to their feet to possibly mask that. But I suspect that after one American classic, we could be getting another as an encore. Not before another bow, though, from David Robertson, musical director of the St. Louis Symphony since 2005, principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and soon to be artistic director of the Sydney Symphony Orchestra too. This is a man who's going to collect a lot of air miles. He's back on stage, bringing the trumpet player Thomas Drake to his feet. Principal trombone Timothy Myers and tuba player Michael Sanders. Clarinetist Diana Haskell, and now the whole gang on their feet I think it's fair to say that Chaprom's audience have enjoyed this concert. David's now asking if they want an encore, and you heard the response. Possible in this best of all possible worlds. What a great encore to choose for this debut prom by the St. Louis Symphony, the overture to Candide by Leonard Bernstein. Like I say, an American classic. from some American visitors who proved very popular with the Proms audience this evening and who I'm sure will be warmly welcomed back. St. Louis Symphony, based in Missouri, doing extremely well with Grammys coming out of their ears under their musical director, David Robertson. And indeed, just a couple of years ago, a recording they made of John Adams' Dr. Atomic, a symphony was named Best CD of the Decade by the Times. And funnily enough, you can hear John Adams tomorrow here at the Proms conducting his work, Nixon in China. Well, as David Robertson once again brings his orchestra, the St. Louis Symphony, to their feet, it is time, I'm afraid, for me to say goodnight and hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House. Good evening.
Katie, thank you very much. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And as she said, we're back there tomorrow evening for a complete performance of an opera conducted by an American visitor and about an American visitor. It's John Adams' Nixon in China, with the composer himself conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. An earlier than usual start time, 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. And as you may know, John Adams is also our current Composer of the Week. So the third instalment of Donald MacLeod's series also has an earlier start time tomorrow evening of 6 o'clock. Now, a word from Petrarch Trelawney.
It might be a piece of music that you grew up with. Might be a piece of music you chose to be performed at your wedding or at a friend's party. Might be something taught to you by a beloved piano teacher. Perhaps the first piece of music you heard live in concert. Whatever it is, we'd like you to tell us about it on Your Call. Your Call is a daily part of breakfast on BBC Radio 3. It's very simple. We talk to listeners on the air, on the phone, just for a couple of minutes and get them to tell us why a particular piece of music is so special to them. What piece of music would you choose? We'd love to hear from you. Free breakfast at bbc.co.uk. Tell us the piece of music that you choose for Your Call and be part of breakfast 7 days a week here on BBC Radio 3.
And Petrarch will be back in this very, sitting in this very chair from 6:30 tomorrow morning. Well, next, this evening on Radio 3, another chance to hear one of our features from last year. The Guardian's dance critic, Judith McCrell, will be looking at the exciting future of the dance world in A Movement Beyond Dance. That's in just over 10 minutes from now at 10 o'clock. It's followed by the second of this week's Radio 3 essays on the history of the music appreciation movement at 10:45. And then Max Reinhardt is here live at 11 o'clock with the first of this week's Late Junctions. So before Judith McCrell's programme at 10 o'clock, here's some more American music, South American this time. From a disc of Astor Piazzolla's music, arranged and played by Guidon Kremer and friends, this is Piazzolla's Concerto for Quintet. Thank you. Astor Piazzolla's Concerto for Quintet, arranged and played by Gidon Kremer, violin, Paul Mayer, clarinet, Vadim Sakharov, piano, Alois Posch, double bass, and Per Orne Glorvigen, bandoneon. This is BBC Radio 3. Stay tuned for our feature, which is coming next.
The 2012 BBC Proms season goes out with a bang. On the two nights before the last night, a pair of BBC Proms concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink. Haydn, Strauss, Bruckner, and Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, played by Murray Pariah. The Vienna Philharmonic at the BBC Proms. Thursday and Friday nights at 7 and 7.30 on BBC Radio 3.
And that'll be presented by Martin Handley. The Radio 3 essay at 10.45 tonight in this series, the music historian Richard Witts continues to tell the story of the rise and fall of the music appreciation movement. That's the essay in 45 minutes. Now at 10 o'clock on Radio 3, it's time for this evening's feature, A Movement Beyond Dance. The Guardian critic Judith McCrell explores the explosion of activity in the world of dance that's creating one of the most exciting periods in the history of the art form. The programme contains material recorded at the 2010 Contemporary Dance Festival in Venice.
Whoa. This isn't something I'm normally asked to do as a critic. Whoops! I'm suspended from the ceiling and I'm trying to swing and clamber my way through this forest of hanging rings. I've never personally been on an assault course before. Whoa! Right, oh dear, I don't see a very convenient... Whoops! Ring to...
The Hayward Gallery might be one of London's most famous spaces for the visual arts, but recently it's had an exhibition called Move that doesn't so much invite spectators to look at the work, but to dance their way through it. I went along to try out the contribution of the acclaimed choreographer William Forsyth. It's an installation called The Fact of the Matter, which is basically created out of dozens of hanging gymnast rings. Forsyth challenges us to swing a kind of Tarzan-like route through these rings. And as I discovered, it's no way as easy as it looks.
Halfway through, I've just fallen off. I was overambitious in my reach. I had this huge gap between me and the next ring, and my upper arms were just beginning to go into spasm. You go through such a roller coaster set of physical experiences, from the kind of exhilaration of a good swing to the absolute terror of a bad swing, when you're feeling a sense of your weight and your balance, how to calibrate your body. So it's maybe not dance, but definitely choreography.
You're creating weird and wonderful shapes, and I think if it was put to a piece of music, it could look quite amazing.
Yeah, because it's like the rings create the choreographic rules for you, and you kind of become this impromptu dancer.
Yeah. Even the rings actually start to make noise as well when they clink together, so that could be the music.
I've just watched two girls achieve what I haven't managed to, and they've got from one end to the other without touching the floor. So was that more difficult than it looked?
At first, you try and do it in a swinging technique, just using your arms. You don't realise that actually you can just use the strength in your legs and your feet.
The man who created this, William Forsyth, calls it a choreographic object. Did you feel in any way that you were being set up as a dancer, that you were following some kind of rules, that you were appearing in a kind of piece, performance piece?
When you've actually got the technique going, you feel a lot more graceful, more like a dancer than just some clumsy oaf.
There are some bad moments, aren't there, when you find your legs are going in completely opposite directions.
One of the higher rings hits you in the head, that's great.
Yeah, it's cheap.
She was more like a ballerina, I was more like a gladiator.
My fellow climbers were definitely engaging with Forsyth's rings as a choreographic idea. And I think that's because dance audiences now have become used to seeing movement as part of a wider spectrum of forms and activities, combining with digital art, visual installation, text, music, film. I would say that today's dance scene has become dazzlingly diverse, willing to engage with so many possibilities and ideas. And its impressive audience figures suggest that people don't mind these boundaries being blurred. But some of the work I see does feel very different to the dance I first fell in love with. Dance that was all about these super articulate bodies, expressing through movement what words couldn't say. The idea that dance is just pure movement can seem a bit simple-minded now, but I can't actually believe it's ever going to become passé. Isn't dance always, at some level, going to be about the live human body moving through time and space? At the Hayward, I met up with Betsy Gregory, who's Artistic Director of Dance Umbrella, an international festival of contemporary dance that's held each year in London. Betsy also had a go on the demonic Forsyth rings. So how did she get on?
It didn't last very long. I thought that for safety's sake, I better get off.
I mean, you trained as a dancer, so did you feel that any of your known techniques of balance and coordination were coming into play?
Well, my dance career was a long time ago. For the small amount of time I did it, my skills were not very useful, I'm afraid.
But Forsyth has talked about setting up rules, making us move in certain ways. He's created a live moving installation. Is that dance? Can dance be anything we want it to be?
I once had to write a little essay when I was a student about what is dance and what is not dance. And I think I drew the conclusion that dance could be any organized, therefore choreographed, movement that was intended to be beautiful or watched or seen or participated in. The Forsyth rings are what I would call choreographic in that to animate them, a person has to move through them, and that's part of the intention or the choreography.
You've put together for Umbrella some fairly extreme work, I would say, in the last couple of years. There was the French dancer who was in duet with a mechanical digger, tango duet in a bathroom showroom, man performing on the pavement outside Liverpool Street Station. Do you think it's fair to say that maybe in the last 10 years, dance has really been spreading its boundaries farther and faster than before?
Yes, I do. Dance has become even more global than it was before. Dancers are traveling all over the world. There's been an enormous cross-fertilization. In terms of reaching further and farther in other dimensions, dancers and choreographers are playing with the whole idea of what's real and what's virtual, and we're getting to the point where the technology enables the performance, doesn't override or supersede it. And also, the cross-fertilization with other genres like visual arts and theater has actually always been taking place. It's only really now in this country that we're starting to see those crossings over in a major way and starting to realize that we're looking at works by artists and it doesn't actually matter whether it's dance or whether it's not dance.
I've come to Venice, which is a city of traders and tourists and mercenaries and merchants, and it's always stolen and accumulated its traditions from other cultures, and it seems absolutely natural that it should also be home to the famous Art Biennale, where it showcases the most extraordinary and outrageous art from around the globe, and also that for the last 7 years it should be host to the International Dance Festival. And likewise, this is a festival that takes in dance from around the globe and also showcases an incredible diversity of choreographers and styles. And it's quite significant, I think, that in the introduction to this year's programme, the director Ismail Evo wonders whether the term movement isn't now too narrow a definition for much of what he's programming here.
I think more and more, each festival should, beside of including names, good work, interesting work, intelligent work, curious work, have to space for different ideas, which maybe is not exactly my cup of tea, but it drops something else. And I think the moment for dance today is drop in the table something else, which somehow affects or confronts, because I think that there's no one track to follow any longer.
Given the range of approaches in dance now, I mean, highly conceptual dance, highly technological dance,
absolutely.
Are there some works in the dance festival that actually you sometimes wonder whether they should be in the Art Biennale?
Absolutely. All these type of revolutions from the last century, they just came from the sky like in a spaceship. They were somehow, what I said, people were contaminating themselves earlier enough. That's what I try to create now here in Venice. I think it's a moment of blank canvas. Let's take this blank canvas and drop different colors, different ideas, and give space not just for good or bad. This momentum or this ambient, this laboratory of being together.
One of the most extreme works in the Venice Festival was The Tempest, performed by the Samoan company Mau. This is part of its dark and really unsettling score. Its creator is Lemmy Ponifacio, a choreographer who's also a Samoan high chief. And his work occupies a place that's somewhere between dance, theatre and ritual. The Tempest is a very dreamlike production, and its traditional imagery has a very modern resonance. There's one dancer whose body is covered with a slick of oil, another winged figure who twitches and buckles like a wounded seabird, and there's an elderly man with a most amazing array of tattoos. These creatures all move incredibly slowly across the stage, and it feels as if we're being asked to contemplate them rather than make sense of them. I wanted to know what response Ponifacio expected from us.
I start with this idea when I make theatre that I'm not there to show something. I'm trying to make you be. That's your title, human being.
Could you explain a little bit the elements of Tempest?
I think your questions, you're always asking me what things represent.
Yes.
I'm not an object person.
Yeah.
I like to mark the tension of space in order to support your own contemplation of your existence.
Although we don't look at it and say, oh, that's Samoan, there's elements of your tradition in the movement and the language.
No. I don't dip into my pocket and sprinkle Samoan dust to make it.
No.
Like you have a different accent from me when we speak English. So, you know, that's all it is. It's a very shallow difference that makes us interesting. But deep inside, we're the same. We have our same concern. We all die, and we all love.
And the dancers you work with, some of them, am I right, are not trained dancers?
None of them have been to a dance school or drama school. But I don't look for that. That's much more interesting for me than to put a class of human beings on stage and say, okay, step right, left, center, whatever. Then it just becomes a sequence of organizing some fancy steps that are pleasing to watch. I don't so much participate in dance festivals because, I don't know, it's a different kind of engagement with what I make.
So to attach the label dance to your work can be misleading and confusing, do you think?
Well, it's an English word.
What word would you use?
I don't know. I just make things, and when I go out to make things, I don't think I'm making theatre or dance. I'm just making what I make. And so when people ask me about dance, it's a very odd thing, because then I have to reflect on the history of Western dance. I don't think about those things.
That was a pretty challenging interview, because really all the terminology that I've assembled as a critic was inadequate in the face of what Lemmy Bonifacio believes he's doing. He doesn't think of it in terms of dance. He doesn't really even think of it in terms of theatre. And it's a real example of where the dance scene is today, that, you know, Lemmy's partly saying, well, I don't even want to be in a dance festival, and yet it's hard to think of what other festival would accommodate him. And because he sees his work almost as a way of creating an act of community rather than communication between him and his audience, he makes someone like me redundant. He doesn't want any of the questions that I ask asked of his work. He doesn't want my interpretations. In a way, I'm getting between him and the audience, so he's putting me out of a job. I've just come out from seeing Glow. It's a piece by the Australian company Chunky Move, and I'm really excited by it because I've seen a lot of work that's played with digital technology, where there've been virtual dancers interacting with the live bodies, or where computers have been used to create a kind of set design. But I've never seen a work that's actually billed itself as a duet between a live dancer and a bit of video equipment, which is basically what Glow is. What it does is show you in an incredibly dramatic way how the dancer moves through space. Here, because the light is picking up every movement that she makes, it's as if she's painting in light as she's on the stage. So the trajectory of her movements, the expansion of her movements, it's all made visible in light, and you get a sense both of ecstasy when sometimes she's almost dancing through a light storm, and then real terror where the light seems to be almost engulfing her, or the shadow rather seems to be engulfing her. It's a very dramatic piece, surprisingly dramatic for something that's so dependent on technology.
My name is Christy Eyre. I'm a performer with Chunky Move.
So when you're performing Glow and it's just you and this video tracking system, what kind of relationship do you have with this light on you? Yeah. Is it like another dancer? Is it a projection of yourself?
It feels like a duet of light and movement for me, in a way, because the two are so interconnected, and sometimes as one, other times working independently, but really with a very strong marriage together throughout the work. So I really feel like sometimes the light is driving, sometimes the body is driving, and other times working really coherently together. So it's a very connected relationship.
And physically, is there a frustration doing this work? I mean, do you feel you're not using all the range of your skills?
Absolutely not. If anything, it's completely the opposite. I've found working with this system really liberating, because the dancer is basically in control, because the light and sound is often following your tempo, and whilst the choreography is set completely and is the same whoever performs it, the actual kind of time that you can sit in things and exactly where you need to be within that confined space is really up to you. So for the first time in my career, the performer is in control, so it's really nice.
Gideon Obazanik, who's the director and choreographer of Chunky Move, has just taken us through the theatre where his company is performing. and there's a rehearsal going on. It's very intense, and we go into this extraordinary garden, which is very, very rare in Venice, incredibly green, birds singing, and Gideon's taking a well-earned bit of break in the daylight.
There's a long history of dance using various forms of technology at hand, certainly throughout the 20th century. Fly system, you know, conventional theatre that brings things in and out, lights that turn on and off, microphones that enhance the volume of people's voice. You know, these are just forms of technology to create work with. I think what's interesting with Glow in particular is that it's actually a very human work. And while the images are spectacular and you appreciate how it connects to the body, that's very quickly understood. But what we've really tried to do is really bring out the person who's dancing. And this has been very effective.
There's all these possibilities now of having virtual figures moving with live bodies, of 3D projection, video animation. Do you think there's a danger that we'll lose touch with the flesh and blood power of dance?
I think we already have in many ways lost touch with live performance. A lot of audiences that I deal with, particularly young audiences, their experience of live performance is very small. Some of them none whatsoever. The people's large experiences with screen, whether it be telephones, computers, cinema, television. So the live experience is quite small in the sort of contemporary world. And I work in live performance. For me, it's all about why does this have to be live? The liveness of it, people coming together in the same space, witnessing something, it becomes kind of an event.
When you come to a dance performance, what always strikes me is that the people on stage are actually doing the thing they're doing right there and right then, physically.
Alistair Spalding, artistic director at the Sadler's Wells Theatre in London.
There's no kind of pretense, there's no CGI, there's no tricks. It's absolutely real. And I think there's something in that. You can either do it or you can't do it. And it's a very kind of testing art form. You're there, you're under scrutiny, and you either amaze or you don't. And I think that's great. I think that's one of the greatest strengths of the form. It's very old-fashioned in a way, but I think people respond to that.
With Glow, it's very much about that live situation. And the great thing about this technology is it responds to the dancer, both the sound and the lights. So no performance is ever the same.